Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It was G-Day on Capitol Hill today. Goldman Sachs executives took turns having rotten tomatoes hurled at them by members of the Senate Banking Committee. What did we actually learn about the investment bank's role in the housing meltdown? Well, in the words of Daniel Sparks, former head of Goldman's mortgage arm, "Regret to me means something that you feel you did wrong, and I don't have that." From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 27th day of April. On Capitol Hill today, a financial drama. Let's call it Uncle Sam versus Uncle Sachs. Top officials from the investment bank Goldman Sachs appeared at a Senate hearing and defended themselves against bipartisan fire over some of the trades Goldman was involved in leading up to the financial crisis. The hearing is unrelated to the SEC's investigation of fraud at Goldman, but the topic was front and center anyway. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has been following the hearing, and he joins us now. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Tess.
So give us a little bit of a picture, if you would, of what happened at today's hearing.
Well, you know, I watch a lot of these hearings on financial topics, and they can get pretty boring.
Yes, they
this
can.
This one was not, and not just because it included a lot of profanity, which
Uh-oh.
We won't play, but one of the participants, right out of Hollywood, fabulous Fab Fabrice Tour. He's a 31-year-old Goldman trader, and he's the one that's accused of fraud by the SEC for his role in structuring securities for Goldman's clients to invest in, mm-hmm. securities that Goldman was betting against. Well, he was asked whether he felt a duty to act in the best interest of Goldman's clients.
I believe we have a duty to serve our clients and with respect to our role as market maker to show prices to our clients and to offer them liquidity. I do not believe, you know, we were acting as investment advisors for our clients.
So in other words, Tess, that Goldman is just providing a service by offering clients the ability to place bets on various things. That did not go over well with the senators. There was a lot of frustration that their questions were not being answered satisfactorily, although it could have just been that they didn't like the answers they were getting.
Well, you know, Jeremy, a lot of people are going to look at this as pure political theater. And you think there's anything wrong with that analysis?
Well, it's a fair point. But keep in mind, this is happening just as the Senate is prepared to enact sweeping financial reforms. I spoke with Boston University securities law professor Elizabeth Nowicki. She says what's happening today could actually have a real impact on the rules that govern Wall Street going forward.
Last time we saw massive financial reform was right after Enron imploded. It was a response to Enron. The Goldman employees, the Goldman lawyers are well aware of this issue, and they certainly don't want to give enough ammunition to Congress to justify Congress developing legislation that's really going to significantly curb the business of Goldman Sachs.
And she's talking specifically there about derivatives. And remember, one of the things Congress is considering doing in this financial reform package is severely restricting the trading of derivatives, which is exactly what they were talking about today.
Well, so I guess the bottom line is whether this could actually influence the reform bill at this point, or is this just posturing?
It could. And keep in mind also that for the senators, there's nothing wrong with attacking Wall Street. There's hardly an easier target to find. So having the ability to sit there for hours and attack bankers in front of the camera doesn't hurt during an election year. Just to give you an example, Tess, of one of the more fun moments today, here's an amusing cut from Senator John Ensign, who represents the state of Nevada.
I think most people in Las Vegas would take offense at having Wall Street compared to Las Vegas, because in Las Vegas, actually, people know that the odds are against them. They play anyway. On Wall Street, they manipulate the odds while you're playing the game.
Oh, snap. You know, Jeremy, I think we're also seeing a bit of a culture clash here. Wall Street meets Washington, and that was really on evidence today, wasn't it?
It was. And it's difficult to say who was the home team and who was visiting because the Senators controlled the time. But the issue is really something that the Goldman guys are much more comfortable with talking about in detail. There was one thing that struck me, which was the question of responsibility. The Senators kept coming back to the issue. They would ask the Goldman guys, don't you feel that you have some responsibility to your clients, to shareholders, to the American public, to think about the impacts of the trades that you're doing? And they were basically saying, look, this is business. I'm focused on what is making money for my firm and for me. That didn't sit too well with a bunch of elected representatives who actually do have to think about how things impact the entire economy and the American public.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reviewing today's hearing for us from his seat in New York. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Tess.
The deal at the heart of today's Goldman hearings had to do with those credit default swaps we've all come to know and love over the last couple of years. Okay, maybe know, not love. The swaps are a form of insurance when you buy a bond. If borrowers don't make their payments, the insurance covers your loss. Most credit default swaps were designed for corporate and mortgage bonds, but now they're being sold on muni bonds to investors who think state and local governments are about to go the way of the housing market. Brett Neely reports.
Most investors buy municipal bonds because they believe they're safe. But the recession has driven many state and local governments into deep financial trouble. Some, like California, are potentially in danger of going bust. Some investors want to protect against that happening. Others want to profit from it. Banks are helping them by selling derivatives called credit default swaps.
It's purely a casino.
Michael Greenberger is a former derivatives regulator. He now teaches law at the University of Maryland.
A lot of this is one side betting that California will survive and another side betting that California will fail.
California's treasurer is complaining about these derivatives. He's worried if enough people buy them, it could spook investors and increase the state's borrowing cost. Michael Greenberger describes how that could happen.
It's sort of a piling on. It becomes a whole group of people who want to see the worst happen to the municipality.
And it's not just California. Banks sell these derivatives on debt issued by at least a dozen other states and municipalities. Michael Schozer used to run the Assured Guarantee Corporation, a derivatives specialist. He says credit default swaps get a bad rap. He says they can help states like California because they provide liquidity. That's the ability to buy and sell something easily.
More liquidity generally means better pricing. Less liquid bonds trade worse than more liquid bonds. That's just a fact of life. So the derivatives actually will facilitate liquidity.
Schozer concedes that some investors may want to bet that California will fail, and that can make life very uncomfortable for the state treasurer.
Your job is to get California the lowest borrowing cost possible. So, you know, if you're selling bonds, you're going to be out there saying what a great issuer you are so that people will charge less interest.
Not easy if thousands of speculators are betting against you. Schozer and Greenberger both agree that there isn't much of a market yet for credit default swaps in cities and states.
It's teeny.
For Schozer, that means there doesn't need to be much scrutiny. For Greenberger, that's a good reason to shut down the market before it becomes a big problem. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
It was a second down day in a row on Wall Street. We'll have details when we do the numbers. That massive oil slick from a platform explosion in the Gulf of Mexico is due to reach shore by the weekend. It has the potential to wreak havoc on the coastlines of four states. Cleanup crews are working to contain the spill, which is now bigger than the state of Rhode Island. The accident drove British Petroleum stock down almost 3% just today. And as Sarah Gardner reports, the company's already been slapped with lawsuits.
How much this disaster will cost British Petroleum isn't clear, but families of workers killed in the explosion have sued not only Transocean, the company that operated the rig, but BP as well. BP's already taken full responsibility for shutting down the well and cleaning up the mess. Today, the company said it was spending about $6 million a day battling the spill. But oil expert David Purcell at Tudor Pickering Holt & Company says the cost will really climb if the oil hits land.
Oil hitting the marshland of South Louisiana would be, I think, more significant per foot of coastline soiled than the Prince William Sound issue with the Exxon Valdez.
Purcell says that's because it's easier to clean oil off a rocky coast than marshland. BP doesn't carry insurance for this kind of disaster. John Perry, oil analyst with John S. Herald Company, says that's not too surprising for a company earning billions a year.
They're looking at the statistical odds of a spill and are willing to absorb a certain amount of expense should one occur.
Analysts say long-term, this disaster is more of a risk to BP's reputation than its bottom line. But Purcell says the stakes are high for the entire industry. Insurance premiums will go up for those oil companies that do carry it. The industry also now faces calls for more regulation and emboldened opposition in the U.S. to expanding offshore drilling. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
At least 15 million people are out of work in this country, and many economists say the jobs picture won't get significantly better anytime soon. But that doesn't mean folks aren't trying their best to find openings. And one of the places to do that is at a job fair. Job fairs have been around for a long time, of course, but has their form and function changed during the Great Recession? Andrea Gardner has our story.
The Long Beach Hilton is swarming with people. They carry resumes and straighten their suit jackets. Many are hoping to land a traditional 9-to-5 job, but instead they're finding mostly sales jobs that pay on commission. At one booth, a representative from a direct sales company is showing women how to make money selling products in their homes. At another, State Farm Insurance is promoting an independent contractor program where agents sell policies on commission. Some trade schools have booths too, hoping job seekers sign up for classes.
Jobs are very scarce.
Peggy Hillman works for National Career Fairs, which organized the event. Last year, it canceled some job fairs across the country because so few businesses were hiring. 2010 has picked up, thanks in part to alternative opportunities like these.
People are becoming more and more inventive about how they're going to make an income, and those kind of opportunities work for some people.
John Diamond is here recruiting distributors for his company, Congen Water. It sells water treatment units for homes and businesses. He says many of the people he meets haven't come to grips with the new employment market. Either that, or they don't want to pay $4,000 for a water unit. All distributors are required to buy one up front or pay one off through sales.
I don't have the clock in at 9 and clock out at 5 job anymore. And those job opportunities aren't here, and they're disappointed. You're disappointed in what the reality is.
Diamond says too many job seekers leave empty-handed, preferring to wait for a full-time job in their current trade rather than trying something new. Pat Stevens is among the 500 or so people here. She's hoping to find a full-time secretarial job, but hasn't found any leads. She says commission sales jobs are too great a risk right now.
Somebody has to buy in order for anybody to make any money, and nobody can depend on that, especially in this economy. Where are they getting the money? Everybody's broke.
But not all job seekers were quite as skeptical. Lou Giordani and Vaskin Bajian left the career fair with several brochures.
We're IT engineers, and we're definitely having to look outside the box. So, yeah, we're considering sales positions, opening up businesses, whatnot. Definitely something different than what we're normally doing. Nowadays, you got to go with what's available.
Giordani says he'll likely sell computer products on commission. It could either be a temporary way to make money or the start of his next career. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, the downsizing of Detroit.
If that's what they want to do with this area, fine. Buy me out of my upside-down mortgage, okay? And let me go.
But first, let's do the numbers. Europe's debt worries weighed on the markets today. The Dow tumbled 213 points, almost 2%, to close at 10,991, below that 11,000 mark again. The Nasdaq lost 51 points, just over 2%, to finish at 2,471. And the S&P 500 gave back 28 points, 2.3%, to end trading at 1183. Seems investors sided with the bankers of Goldman Sachs. Despite today's grilling by unhappy senators, Goldman shares rose 2/3%. Earnings season continued today. Ford beat Wall Street expectations, posting more than $2 billion in the first quarter profits. But apparently investors had gotten carried away with their expectations. Ford stocks still hit the skids, dropping more than 6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at HBR.org. And by LendingTree.com. Tools and personalized advice to help control your financial destiny are at the all-new LendingTree.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The House Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on the Credit Card Fair Fee Act of 2009. It's about fees merchants pay each time they swipe a card. Got a question for the Department of Labor? You're invited to participate in live web chats on the department's regulatory agenda. And on April 28, 2001, Dennis Tito became the first space tourist paying for a stay on the International Space Station. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We'll start letters this week with Apple. One a day can keep the doctor away, but losing one in the form of a phone can cause a whole lot of trouble. Last week, we interviewed Gizmodo's Jason Chen about his acquisition of what looks to be the new iPhone model. Chen bought it from someone who found it in a Silicon Valley bar. Apple was not amused, and neither was Fraz Ismat of Lawrenceville, New Jersey.
Not cool, Marketplace. Not cool at all. You gave a national forum to a party that participated in the theft of a device. If I had found your laptop, dissected it, and returned it to you after putting your personal photos online, would I get to be on the radio too?
Turns out the authorities weren't amused either. Last Friday, police and federal agents raided Chen's home, seized a bunch of computer equipment, and have opened an investigation. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission has been grilling Wall Street execs for the past couple of weeks. CEO after CEO claimed they could not have seen the collapse coming. But Hank Tilbury of Prairie Village, Kansas, isn't buying it.
When I bought my home in 2003, brokers were approving me for mortgages that would have cost 60% of my monthly income. I thought they were out of their minds to push something so obviously unsustainable. It's troubling in the extreme to hear our financial geniuses plead ignorance when an humble peasant like me could look at the situation then and see the potential for disaster.
Early last week, we heard from a doctor about how he handles patient questions about health care reform. Dr. Winston Capel told us he's seeing a lot of outrage about the new law, and he's worried it will create more bureaucracy and affect physician morale. His comments prompted responses from across the healthcare spectrum. Kenneth Elliott of Philadelphia echoed what a lot of you had to say.
I was dumbstruck listening to this infuriatingly one-sided interview. I found it unbelievable and irresponsible that you made no effort to challenge Dr. Capel's specious arguments.
And finally, last week we spoke to Annetta Cheek, the director of the Center for Plain Language. The center's mission is to get government and businesses to communicate more clearly, so we asked her to review some of our language.
A little further down, you used the word nefarious, which is one of my favorite words, but I might not have used it in a story on the radio.
David Burns of Needham, Massachusetts, stood with us on that one.
Nefarious is an excellent word everyone should know upon reaching the age of 13, or before voting, or enrolling in the armed forces, or submitting a comment to Marketplace.
If you've got a comment or a question, nefarious in nature or not, let us know. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Arizona's tough new legislation targeting undocumented immigrants is making the state itself a target. The law was passed and signed by the governor less than a week ago, but already the state is facing lawsuits over its constitutionality. Today, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said the federal government may challenge it. Mexico's president is warning of a strain in trade and political ties, and even diehard spring training fans are taking to Facebook to say they'll boycott next year's Cactus League games. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more on the backlash.
Los Angeles is one city considering cutting its economic ties with Arizona. In San Francisco today, elected officials introduced a resolution at a Board of Supervisors meeting. City Attorney Dennis Herrera.
The resolution will consider urging city departments to not enter into contracts to purchase goods and services from Arizona-based companies.
But Arizona's Governor Jan Brewer says she doesn't believe the controversial law will hurt the state's economy. She says business leaders worry more about crimes committed by illegal immigrants.
When I go about meeting with businesses that come into Arizona that are trying to locate here or businesses that are here, they want to know that we have a safe and secure environment.
But the environment for tourism has been soured by the legislation.
It is affecting us as a business significantly.
Will Conroy is president of the Arizona Inn, a small boutique hotel in Tucson. In recent days, he's received calls and emails from loyal customers who have changed their travel plans.
It's just upsetting to read these emails. People that love the inn, but that are putting their feelings about Arizona first, and they won't be coming back, they say.
Arizona was the target of another boycott in the 80s when the state initially refused to adopt a Martin Luther King holiday. Hundreds of conventions were canceled, and the state lost the chance to host the Super Bowl. So far this time, only one group has pulled out, appropriately the American Immigration Lawyers Association. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
In 1950, Detroit was the country's fourth largest city. Nearly 2 million people called it home. Today, the Motor City has less than half that number. But Detroit still spends close to $3 billion a year to provide city services, even in neighborhoods that are largely abandoned. So local officials are considering a radical idea: shut down whole swaths of the city and move residents from decaying neighborhoods to more viable areas. Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett reports.
Elaine Levitt's neighborhood looks like a lot of Detroit. There are some well-kept homes, like hers, but not too far away, there are blocks with more vacant lots than standing homes. And some of those houses are abandoned eyesores. Levitt has lived in this neighborhood since 1965.
This is the only neighborhood I know of in the city of Detroit where I can walk after dark. Nobody bothers us. This is one of the safest areas in the city.
But Levitt may soon be asked to leave the neighborhood. Led by Mayor Dave Bing, Detroit officials have begun looking for ways to shrink the city. Detroit covers nearly 140 square miles, and the city has racked up a $300 million deficit, providing services like streetlights, fire protection, trash pickup, and police patrols. Despite repeated requests for an interview, Bing did not comment for this story. But he told local radio station WJR, Detroit cannot afford to maintain services in every neighborhood. Bing said the city has no choice but to downsize.
If we don't do it, you know, this whole city is going to go down. And, you know, I'm hopeful that people will understand that. If we can incentivize some of the folks that are in those desolate areas, they can get a better situation. If they stay where they are, I absolutely can give them all the services that they require.
Bing's plan is to consolidate residents into a limited number of neighborhoods. That way, the city can provide services more efficiently and cheaply. But it's not clear which neighborhoods would be targeted or how many people would need to relocate. One idea is to downsize areas with the highest crime rates. Another possibility could be to close down neighborhoods next to the dozens of public schools scheduled to close this year. One of those schools is across the street from Elaine Lovett.
If that's what they want to do with this area, fine. Buy me out of my upside-down mortgage, okay, and let me go.
So far, there are no formal plans for how the city would carry out the downsizing, whether through incentives, buyouts, or eminent domain. It's also not certain how it would be paid for. Detroit plans to use $20 million from the federal government to help tear down 10,000 vacant buildings over the next 3 years. But the city will likely need more money, perhaps hundreds of millions more, to relocate residents. And money won't be the only challenge. John Moak teaches law at Wayne State University. He says there will certainly be some people who won't want to leave their homes, and that could mean using eminent domain to force them out.
In 2006, the state of Michigan amended its state constitution, and it prohibited the use of eminent domain to assemble land for economic development. It also made it more difficult to clear blighted neighborhoods.
Moak says those changes could mean more litigation and higher relocation costs. There could also be a political cost. Many residents have painful memories of Detroit's previous attempts at urban renewal. One of them is Ron Scott. He says his family was forced to relocate twice in the 60s, first to make way for a new housing development, and again when planners decided to build Interstate 75. Scott says this latest plan sounds no different.
It's just like the old reservations. You tell the Native Americans, we're going to give you land somewhere else, and you move them somewhere else, and then there's no clear understanding as to what's going to happen.
Detroit isn't the first Rust Belt city to try downsizing. After its steel mills closed and many residents fled, Youngstown, Ohio began offering incentives for remaining residents to move out of decaying neighborhoods. But now, 5 years since the plan was adopted, not a single resident has taken the $50,000 relocation incentive. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note. Womp, 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 womp. Translation for those of you who don't speak adult. Charlie Brown and the gang have a new place to call home. The Scripps newspaper company is selling its licensing unit to Iconix Brand Group for $175 million. That unit represents the Peanuts gang, as well as Dilbert and Raggedy Ann and Andy. At Iconix, they'll share a playground with the likes of Joe Boxer and that cutie London Fog. Charles Schultz's family also gets an ownership interest in the deal. Womp, 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 womp. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 213 points, almost 2%. The Nasdaq fell 51 points, just over 2%. And the S&P 500 dropped 28 points, 2.3%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Next time on the program, the science behind success.
It's a combination of the hours and the appetite, the kind of practice which leads to the personal transformation.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.